Brigadier Crabby, Reel 4. Was there much mess formality?
Yes, it was not terribly harsh as a rule, but for the ordinary dinner night, you usually went in to the dining room according to your seniority, which I think one would normally have done in way of ordinary politeness. And you had a president and vice president at either end of the table. And I think one always had drank to the King Emperor at the end of dinner. But apart from that, there was no undue formality, you know. It was really very easygoing. One had some amusing sidelights here. I remember one terrible scene in one of these cavalry regiments. We had one officer, splendidly amusing chap, who'd served in submarines, and for some reason, a very personal one, I think, he decided that he'd better spend 3 years in India, and he managed to get a commission in this regiment. And what he dearly loved after dinner was some fruit. And it was a tradition of this regiment that you only had nuts after dinner. So he could over drinks before dinner, he hatched a plot whereby he would ask for fruit. So he asked for fruit after dinner. And the two IC of the regiment, a very flamboyant type, heard this frightful demand and said, "Sir, we only take nuts after dinner." And this chap decided that went on and demanded fruit. So he was put under arrest. "Sir, you're under arrest. Go to your bungalow." He trotted to his bungalow. And then I rarely forget the sequence of events, but it ended up in the most horrific party in this chap's bungalow. And then for some reason or other, I may have got the sequence wrong, but this roughly is the story, that we all went off to the club where more drinks happened. And then we had a coach and four. And this being India, nobody bothered about that it was 10 o'clock at night. Certainly the Indians didn't. They're delighted sitting up all night. So coach and four was sent for. And all of us in the coach and four galloped back to the mess, flat out down the Mall, which was on the main road. And just as that seemed a little bit too easy, there were sort of big drives leading into the more important bungalows all the way along the main road. So the very skillful driver shot in and out of these drives at full gallop with the coach and four, you see. I think probably there was somebody operating on the horn at the same time, tootling away. Naturally, this got reported next morning as a horrifying incident, you see. And the CO had everybody up, and nobody could say who was driving. And I think we were all, roughly speaking, put in under arrest. But it all ended up very happily. It never came to court-martial. And that all happened over mess etiquette, over nuts or fruit. But again, typically Indian Army.
This was the 18th Cavalry. Again,
it was, as you might imagine.
How suited was the army clothing to Indian conditions?
Pretty good on the whole. You worked once you got in the hot weather. You worked in shirt sleeves. Mess kit again. You went in a hot weather mess kit, which was. Fairly suitable. It was light white material, and of course you had no trouble with your laundry bills, because you simply probably had a different suit every night, which was washed for you that day and clean again in the evening. So on the whole, I think the clothing was very suitable. High collar perhaps at night was not all that suitable, but one got by. One learned to suffer a little, perhaps.
You told me earlier about the a little bit about how you used to spend your free time with the hounds and so on. What other methods did you have for spending your spare time apart from in the mess and the hounds?
Oh, yes. Well, here, of course, you had, in a place like Peshawar, of course, you had a very social life. You had the race course, and here again, it was all amateur racing, or most of it, you know, officers and others riding their own horses or the horses of friends, and you had the training to do. You had the polo, which meant not just playing polo, but schooling your ponies. There was a golf course of sorts, and tennis at the club. And altogether, one could live a very full social life in the bigger stations like Peshawar and Rawalpindi. And there, of course, you were in the evenings, in the cold weather at any rate, there were parties and dancing and so on and so forth. So altogether, you had a very gay time. In the smaller stations, and of course the non-family stations, it was very much more restricted. Usually they ran to some sort of a golf course, which was all sand, so you had to paint your balls red to find them again, or green, or some such colour. There'd usually be a bit of tennis on hard courts, and again you'd play probably very bad polo on simply terrible dusty grounds. And a lot of people would go out shooting chakor, sort of desert partridge sort of things, which meant trekking miles into the country and spending a very hot and dusty day. Some people would... These were the more adventurous, perhaps rather more intelligent types who'd go out after bigger game. Here I'm thinking about chaps who really did get to know the country and the language, and they'd go out on shikar and go out after macaw, mountain sheep, and things like that, which would mean several weeks trek in the mountains. And here you didn't need to know the or certainly get the help and advice and consent of the political agent and see to it that you didn't get your throat cut unnecessarily, though I never knew this happened. So that you could get wherever you were, it was really up to you to make the most of the country. And the British Army of the time was very much field sports orientated, very much encouraged, of course. There's no better way of knowing the country than riding across it on a horse. If you just sort of drive along the road, you've got no idea what you're up against. Or there was, in some parts, there was excellent fishing, and here again, very much encouraged. I think the whole idea of army life then was to encourage people to keep fit, to get acclimatized, to know the country outside the cantonment, and generally to make yourself into a useful soldier, that you did not sit around in the cantonment. And although things like tennis and so on were nice enough, they much preferred you got out and around and saw the country, and certainly for the Indian units that you learned the language properly, not just a few words to your bearer and things like that.
You said that you were on an Urdu course. Did you learn the language?
Oh, I learned, yes. I learned it up to a higher standard Urdu. There one had... I had a munshi, a teacher, I suppose about three afternoons a week. They'd come in and spend an hour with you. And you had a standard textbook called the munshi, of course, and... from this you swatted up the vocabulary and so on and practiced on your bearer and your troops and anybody else who'd listen to you. And they're usually terribly polite and didn't correct you unless you asked them. Your troops didn't correct you as a rule, your bearer always did.
And you found it really useful, did you, to have learned the language?
Yes, certainly. Difficult, mind you. It's not the same as learning French or Italian in that there's very little real literature. The set textbook was written originally in Urdu by an Indian officer, this is a Rizaldar, I think, at the time of the mutiny. A very good description of India at that time, and a good textbook. But I never remember reading any other Indian book. And I think this is really, when you say, was it useful? Yes, certainly it was necessary. But it gave you very little insight into the real life of the country. And I don't honestly remember either reading a newspaper in Urdu script. That is, one, of course, read the Indian print in the ordinary Arabic script, but one didn't read the Roman script. But one never read it for vernacular newspapers, so you never really knew, perhaps, what was felt about the political side. You only knew the bigger newspapers published in Lahore, Bombay and Calcutta.
What newspapers did you read personally?
I think the Statesman was our chief one, and there's one other, something Lahore Times or something, I forget.
Civil and Military Gazette?
Civil and Military Gazette, that was the one, yes. Those are the two.
Did you find the relative scarcity of female company, especially in these smaller stations, a problem? You and the other officers? Or did you not really miss it?
Tremendous excitement, of course, or excitement amongst few when the sort of cold weather draft of young women arrived from England, the so-called fishing fleet. And there used to be great goings on here and there, tremendous rivalry. And there used to be a certain amount of nonsense went on holiday in Kashmir, the system being that the husband stayed down in the plains for most of the hot weather and the wife went up to Kashmir possibly for 6 months. And of course with her continual exchange of young officers, the wives did very often, and the young subalterns got up to no good whatsoever. But this is only to be expected. But as to whether it caused much worry, one wouldn't think so. No more nonsenses went on than probably less than goes on in the suburbs now. You know, the odd wife would go astray. But the remarkable thing is that it didn't happen more often, probably because that. It was such a small community, and you could barely move without everything being seen and noted and commented on, and there was very little opportunity in that way. To the best of my belief, there was never any sort of homosexual business went on. You would expect it according to modern literature, but somehow it never seemed to happen, or not to one's knowledge at any rate. There, the Pathan is a very homosexual type, but it never seemed to spread to his British counterpart. Pathan, I think the sort of local saying is that sort of women for children but boys for pleasure, but as I say, it was it never sort of crept into the sort of British customs.
Did the officers have trouble with Pathan troops in this respect?
Not to my knowledge. I never knew any real Pathan units like the Guides Cavalry. I think these were very well-disciplined troops. And when one says well-disciplined, as you say, you must remember they were very family units too, and their Rizaldars and so on kept a very strict eye on morals and goings-on, and it was just not permitted.
In the early days of British rule, the British officers were noted for their liaisons some of the native women. Did this go on in your time?
No. Not to any extent. In fact, I never knew anybody who had an Indian mistress. Possibly I would have done if I'd lived in somewhere like Bombay, but certainly up the north end of the country it didn't happen. Possibly because places like Bombay, you'd meet probably very lovely Indian women socially, and then liaisons naturally happen. But this didn't happen in northern India. You would very seldom, the only Indian women of that sort of class, and India was even more class conscious than we are, would be the wives of Indian commission of King's Commission Indian officers. They were often very lovely women, and very often educated in England or Paris, and delightful to know. But I never knew anything of that nature. Sometimes, as people would risk VD, and this was very, very rife in the bazaars, and go down there. British troops certainly did. They'd use brothels and so on. But it was very unwise, you know, the rate of venereal infection was very high indeed.
Did you ever know of any officers who used brothels?
No, not in India. Nearest we got to it was my dear 18th Cavalry again. I hope this tape will be censored. We'd had a terrific party at the club, and my host, full of joie de vivre and whiskey, shouted to his bearer, saying, "Bring five fat women from the bazaar and five bottles of beer." And he brought five bottles of beer, and then about half an hour later, the bearer came in and said, "Sahib, the women are here." So we had the embarrassing business of paying them off and sending them away. But that was the nearest we got to it.
Without having touched them?
No.
Did the Viceroy's commissioned officers amongst the Indian troops keep their women rigidly separate from the British officers, or did you meet them socially?
In my time, very rigidly separate. One very seldom saw them except on very special occasions. You might, if you're very honoured and lucky, be asked for a wedding, for instance. And there you'd see this very bashful, very lovely girl, probably completely covered in her dowry of gold bracelets and whatever, and some beautiful sari. Probably that was the first and last time you ever saw her.
Was this a Muslim wedding or a Hindu wedding?
I can't honestly remember. I really can't.
Did you make any Indian friends?
Not, you might say, amongst the civilian population. I made a number of Indian friends who were serving officers. But that, you know, is just a matter of meeting in the mess and having common interests. And nearly all of them had been educated in England. You know, certainly Sandhurst. So there was nothing particularly difficult or, you know, unseemly in doing this. But I'm afraid one had one's contact with the civil population in these cantonments was almost nil.
Were Indians allowed in the clubs?
The beginning of my time in India, most clubs wouldn't accept them. But during my period, which was 33 to 38, they were gradually accepting them, little by little. Not much worse, mind you, than the jockey club here and other things. You know, we still hadn't, you know, some of these clubs in England still won't accept women, and certain of them, I think, despite the Race Discrimination Act, wouldn't accept anybody with a coloured skin. But the prejudice was being broken down very gradually and sometimes forcibly. Most of the intelligent people gladly welcomed these Indians, whom I must say were usually extremely intelligent, well-educated men. Some of them aped British fashions overmuch. You know, they're almost too English. Usually had very beautiful Savile Row suits, and they'd all drink whiskey and say, "Old boy," and so on. But on the whole, they were very, very good examples of their race, but possibly not Indian enough. This was their what one could fault them about. They were not sufficiently their own race. They were too British.
Were you ever invited into an Indian's home?
Not except, no, not really, except when you say home, you mean, you see, most of these Indians, when I'm talking about these, what I call brother officers, and they'd have sort of, they wouldn't be in their own homes proper, they'd have sort of makeshift bungalows like yourself, or if you're up in somewhere like similar flats, and one did get invited there, much as you get invited by one's own English for drinks, you know, there was no worry about that. As I say, their families, their wives had often had a European education, so there's no worry. It was the real, what you would call, sort of uncontaminated Indian that you never really met, practically ever, under domestic situations. I remember once being stranded on the road coming back from Fort Sandeman with a couple of other officers. Car broke down, not infrequent in those days, and we stopped off at this place, Hindu Bagh, which consisted of a little railway halt, and the only person there was the man in charge of the station, little what you might call a babu type, a clerk, spoke good English, a Hindu, remarkably brave man. Of course, this was Pathan country, and they tended to kill off Hindus as a matter of principle. But he'd walk around with a shotgun and be completely happy, apparently. But he took us in. We didn't see his family, but he took us into his house for the night, bedded us down on the floor. He obviously only had one bed, and fed us, and refused to accept any payment. He was most hospitable, could not have been kinder or more generous. But as I say, you didn't meet his family. These were things apart.
What arrangements were made for leave for you?
Well, here, you remember, there was the British Army were out on a five-year tour, and you got 2 years leave, two months leave a year, except in the non-family stations where it was 3 months. So to get to India, to England, would take you, really, most of your leave, sort of at least 2 weeks there and 2 weeks back by ship. And you could just start flying. It was something of an adventure, but there was a sort of flying boat service, I think about once a week, which took about 3 or 4 days. But this was expensive and exotic, and few people did it. So most leave was either taken in Kashmir, where the two principal places were Srinagar, where you tended to live on a houseboat. And then when that sort of tended to pall, you would take a little team of ponies and trek off into the hills, either for shooting or fishing. There was very good trout fishing there, rainbow trout, and of course shooting those bear and all sorts. Or you could go further up the hill to Gulmarg, which was about 7,000 feet, where there were several very beautiful turf golf courses, some of the few in India. And there you could play golf and do a bit of mountain climbing, because the mountains around went up to about 14, 15,000. And generally spend a very vigorous open-air holiday. Some people did get as far as the Seychelles. This was quite an exotic little holiday. You'd go over there and depended on the trade winds here, if you could get an Arab dhow sort of sailing off to the Seychelles, this was quite a little trip, which would take you probably all. You had to get your leave at the right time. You know, you had to get the trade winds sort of blowing in the right directions at the right time.
Did you go yourself?
No, I didn't, as a matter of fact. No, I stuck to the Kashmir business, fishing and golf and houseboat. You might say it was my sort of idea of leave. Some people, one leave I did spend up this research place I was telling you about in the foothills of the Himalayas, Mukteza. And there were a few tiger around, and I did attempt to shoot a tiger, but never saw one actually. Sat up all one night and never saw a thing, and was heartily ticked off for that, because this was an area where you got tick typhus. It's rickettsia condition. We got to know only too well in Burma, which can be very fatal. So that sort of jungle bashing became rather unpopular when one realized that a lot of the so-called fevers one got were in fact rather deadly and not susceptible to drug treatment at that time.
Who ticked you off?
Well, actually, the chap in charge of this research institute. Wonderful place up in the hills. It had been another little instance of how things went on in India. Originally, it had been in Lahore to make smallpox vaccine from calves. This caused great annoyance amongst the Sikhs and Hindus, that with their prejudice against cattle being killed in any shape or form. So it was deliberately, this research institute was taken away into these hills and dumped about 25 miles from railhead. And the only way up to it was either to walk or take a pony. And you went up by hill paths. And this it was certainly quite a large little village, was taken up on the backs of coolies and on ponies, all the befittings. And some of these technicians, the laboratory types, who are very gentle, kindly people, the Babu type, would get up to this hill station and be so terrified at the precipices and the dangers of getting there by pony that they'd never leave. I suspect that some of the chaps I knew are still there.